time once again for a community forum, and we are very lucky to have with us live in the studios this morning Jonathan Lawson, who is the director of Reclaim the Media, Mike Tierney, who is with Blue Team Management, he's formerly with Cube, VH1, and Epic Records, and Ann Chadovitz, who is the National Director of Sound Recordings for AFTRA, the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. And we're going to be talking about the state of radio today. Thank you all three for coming in.
Thank you.
Let me start out, ask you if you can kind of give us a summary of where are we with radio and radio ownership today. Who'd like to jump in?
Well, this is Jonathan. Morning, Mike. In Seattle, especially, and around the country over the past few months and the last year, there's been a major buzz about media ownership reform in general, centered on the FCC's June 2nd deregulation from last year, which basically extended the deregulation, which had already occurred in the radio industry about 8 years ago, to other media. But in the past year, we haven't really discussed radio ownership so much. The situation of the industry is that we have the biggest company, Clear Channel, owns upwards of 1,250 radio stations. Before the 1996 deregulation that removed the ownership caps, they owned, I think, something like 40 stations. That was the upper limit. Everybody, I think, has their own complaints about how radio sounds these days, but I think a lot of things, including the inability of local artists to break on radio anymore, the lack of public affairs programming on many stations, increasing commercialization, and including the most recent indecency flaps, a lot of people are connecting these things to the kind of what they see as out-of-control consolidation. We're going to try to talk a little bit about how to turn that back a little bit.
I got into radio in 1986 and then left radio to go work in television and then at a record label in 98. So, I mean, you know, I am cautious of sounding like an old-timer saying when I was coming up in the business, but, you know, having left radio in 1998, it is in no way the same industry now that I left then. And, I mean, to the point where people who, you know, my colleagues at the radio, you know, at the record company would say, Mike, it was that way when you were there. You don't understand how the game gets played now. So, you know, I mean, to me, what I think is, you know, a little bit alarming is how, in literally, as Jonathan said, since 1996, this kind of change can take place. And, you know, a company like, you know, Clear Channel, who really kind of under the public kind of radar has come to own 1,200, you know, radio stations. And, you know, it's a company that not a lot of people, you know that much about. And, you know, and the game has changed that much in an eight-year period since a telecom bill, you know, reduced or, you know, kind of removed ownership caps. And it's something that, you know, I believe Bill Clinton has been on the record a couple of times as saying, you know, was probably a mistake and something that he maybe wouldn't have signed now if he could, you know, knowing where things went since he did it. So I think that, you know, people, you know, have a kind of curiosity about who some of these players are, how all of this, you know, came to happen. And, you know, to me, it's just, you know, the playing field has changed because of, you know, consolidation, not just of ownership, but consolidation of power in, you know, in just a very few people's hands.
Hi, this is Anne, and I think it's very good that we in the public are active on this issue and are examining it right now. I'm from Washington, and with the deregulation rulings in June, everybody acknowledged that radio's broken. Radio's the canary in the coal mine with what happens, you know, with deregulation and how it's wrong. And on today, there's going to be a forum and a panel about how we can fix it so we can do something positive. And it's very important. I think it's free to come and, you know, be heard about, you know, let's look for positive solutions, because I think there is a window of opportunity now to get in there and say, look, these are some of the problems. This is what you should do. Because communities are, I mean, when somebody is given a license, a radio license, the license is to serve the local community. That's not happening anymore. If it's a big corporation, they're looking at serving their shareholders that who aren't in the local community. And they, you know, may program nationally, keeping local artists off the air. or hire exclusive independent promoters so that you have to pay that person to make to be on the radio. And all these things are hurting the local community, hurting the listener who thinks they're hearing the best music when maybe they're just hearing the artist that has enough money to make the payments. And I think that it's that we have a unique window, an open window that we can try and address it.
And I do think that people in Seattle are, you know, relative to other markets in the country, pretty spoiled for choice. I mean, KEXP is an option, you know, programming option that a lot of radio listeners in America don't have. They obviously avail themselves of on the internet. And the internet and satellite radio and some of these other choices are luring people away from, you know, the FM dial where they're, you know, they see things as being kind of, you know, tightly programmed, lack of variety, lack of, you know, diversity. You know, but in Seattle also you do have, you know, popular radio stations like Cube in the End that are pretty much programmed by local people that are, you know, I think the End's entire air staff, full-time air staff, is Seattle natives. Cube, everybody but the T-Man who does mornings is from Seattle. Seattle educated, Seattle born, Seattle bred. It is worse. And that's like kind of, you know, the other places that it is in Seattle. And it's kind of one of the, you know, ironies of this kind of movement that, you know, Jonathan, you know, can speak more about coming from, you know, Seattle is that things in Seattle are relatively good. It gets a lot worse, you know, when you leave our little oasis here.
And I think one other thing that a lot of people don't realize is Clear Channel, not only do they own 1,243 radio stations, they own the biggest concert promotion company. I believe they were responsible for selling the same number of tickets as, like promoters number 2 through 20-something combined. And they also have billboards. And they also own concert venues.
Television stations.
In some markets, I mean, they promote the concert, they play at their venue, and they play them on the radio, and they leverage that.
And that's another thing about Seattle is that, you know, the booking business is very competitive here. And, you know, in Clear Channel compared to other markets, I think they have an exclusive at the White River Amphitheater. But there's they have competition there with the Gorge. And there are a lot of locally based, you know, bookers here in Seattle as well. So, I mean, it is, you know, it is a lot worse other places. And they have, one of the things that has gotten Congress's attention is their ability to bully, you know, certain people to play with that, you know, to play their venues in certain markets, you know, under the threat of not getting played on their, you know, radio station in those markets. It's, you know, I mean, that's the threat. I personally don't know of situations where that happened, but one of that type of synergy has gotten, you know, Congress a little bit concerned.
Yeah, there's, I think one thing that's certainly true around the country, and including here in Seattle, is the perception that as these companies get bigger, the money is flowing out of the local area, and the accountability to local community drops, even in a place in Seattle where, as Mike has pointed out, there's a relatively high percentage of local DJs. That's Clear Channel has moved into our community relatively recently. Clear Channel is one example. They're not the biggest owner. I think both Viacom/Infinity and Intercom have significantly more stations. Clear Channel owns Cube, KJR, KHO FM, and KJR AM in Seattle. But there's always the possibility, as happened and has happened in San Francisco and other major markets, where there was a station owned by Clear Channel that had a reputation for being a real community voice and a real community resource, such as KMEL in San Francisco. But then at a certain point, turned around pretty quickly with some different kind of management priorities and so forth. And it's the threat of that community access being taken away. I don't think Cube has any public affairs programming at all, as one example, not to pick on Clear Channel. But I think the reduction in local political coverage especially has really changed what radio, commercial radio, can be. We should be careful about trying to say that things have gotten worse compared to some sort of golden age of non-consolidated,
right?
Because it really, there is no such golden age.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But I do think that things have, I mean, my point that I made was just that, you know, it's kind of alarming to me that in my, you know, career, I'm, you know, not an old man. I'm 35 years old. In my career in radio, this has happened. This isn't like going back to people sitting around the, you know, console RCA listening to The Shadow, you know, on a Friday night. This is, you know, this is this a past that everybody listening to this, you know, can remember.
Definitely.
And yeah, you know, I mean, it wasn't perfect, you know, back then. But I do think Jonathan makes a really good point that Clear Channel, you know, the cluster that it owns here is a recent Clear Channel acquisition. You know, I mean, they haven't maybe, you know, you could say slid down the slippery slope, you know, of non-localism. And you know, for our panel, you know, this afternoon, we kind of, you know, as everyone has said, have moved on to, you know, what can we do about things? What kind of policy, legislative, you know, kind of things can we do to keep things from getting worse, improve them, bring them back to, you know, a time where there is some accountability. And, you know, there's still time to do that. You know, I really believe that, especially in Seattle.
Maybe we should say just a little bit about the panel this afternoon. It's I don't think we have yet. It's called the Fixing Radio Forum. It's going to be at the EMP starting at 3 p.m. this afternoon. It's free. Come on down and get a ticket early because it's sure to fill up. It's in the JBL Film Theater down there. It's co-sponsored by Reclaim the Media, the Recording Academy, Pacific Northwest Chapter, KEXP, the EMP, and Music for America. Did I forget anybody? Future of Music Coalition, of course, yeah, from D.C. also. We've got two panels, one panel consisting of radio professionals and previous radio professionals from Intercom, KEXP, The End, KVCS, and several other local stations, including Chris Bennett Broadcasting and a former Pacifica Radio ED, and a second panel with musicians whose kind of perspective we're featuring a little bit, and activists like me. We're gonna the point of the overall event is not to bash radio, but to start from a starting point that there's a consensus that commercial radio is not doing as much for our culture and our democracy as it could be, and how can we change that through progressive legislative remedies?
And I think that, you know, I mean, the fact that so many broadcasters have come out to be on the first panel, which is kind of, you know, the state of radio, you know, today, it's, you know, I mean, not to be glib about it, it's kind of proof, you know, that they're really, you know, these people are doing their job, you know, the best that they can. The fact that they're kind of letting down the curtain, making things a little bit more transparent is kind of to the point that they're really, in my opinion, aren't necessarily kind of bad broadcasters, but, you know, bad broadcast regulation, you know, for the last, like, 6 or 8 years. But, you know, I think everybody, it really becomes difficult, in my experience, when you have, you know, ownership that isn't local and they're, you know, kind of meddling with, you know, with the day-to-day operations of a radio company. I mean, one of the things that I think kind of, you know, makes me a little bit, you know, more passionate than most people about this is that, you know, quite literally, some of the first jobs that I had in radio aren't there anymore. They're now voice tracked, you know, out of market. And voice tracking is something that, you know, some of the larger companies do by having their jocks in one market double up by actually doing an air shift in Little Rock, Arkansas, or whatever, at the end of their shift in Seattle. So to people, you know, I grew up in a medium-sized market, Syracuse, New York, where I actually had opportunities as an 18-year-old to, you know, to get on the air. Sooner or later, the way you used to get started in radio is that sooner or later, if you hung around long enough, everybody else at the station would be too intoxicated to go on the air, and they'd have to put you on the air. And suddenly, you know, you're a broadcaster. But those days are, you know, again, gone. And I think that, you know, to Clear Channel, who own 1,200 radio stations, if you can eliminate, you know, $1,200, $18,000, $20,000 a year jobs, you know, that's 20-something million dollars. But is it worth, you know, the local impact? Is it worth kind of, you know, cutting yourself off from what used to be a breeding ground for, you know, future radio talent and future executives and the entry-level job, you know, in radio, let's face it, is doing, you know, graveyard. And those jobs don't really, you know, kind of exist anymore. And that's something that, you know, at a macro level, if you're Clear Channel, makes a lot of sense. If you start breaking it down, you have to ask yourself, is it worth the loss in localism? Is it worth the loss in jobs? Is it worth, you know, worth the loss of opportunities for, you know, for kids growing up listening to a radio station?
And this is Ann again. The voice tracking is a serious issue because the public is deceived. I mean, the pub, they don't announce that they're voice tracking. They pretend that the voice is coming locally. They are given cheat sheets, things like that. And it's not, it may right now be predominantly in the smaller markets, but Clear Channel and others have actually proposed, they wanted the ability to voice track in some of the largest markets.
Especially in overnights. It's the overnight shifts where they see themselves being able to kind of, you know, make small cuts that will add up chain-wide.
But in some of the biggest markets, so it's a real issue for people. I mean, I don't know if everybody in Seattle knows about what happened in Minot, North Dakota, where Clear Channel owned all the radio stations, and there was a truck carrying chemical gas that crashed, and there was a danger. I mean, and they tried to call all the radio stations to get an announcement out to the community. And they were all being voice tracked, and nobody answered the phone. And
everybody was too intoxicated to get
on
there.
And if I recall, I'm not sure the number of people that ended up being hospitalized. I mean, this was a serious incident. And, you know, stations have a license to serve their local community. Well, they're supposed to be doing that.
And it's not only that. This is kind of where, you know, where to me it becomes interesting is that, you know, it used to be that the three most kind of what we called non-preemptive values of radio were always live, always local, always portable. You know, that was what made us different from TV, different from, you know, from newspapers. It was what our competitive advantage was. So, you know, look, it's up to every company gets to come up with their own business model. But I just question the wisdom of a business model where you take away live and local, which are two of the three, you know, non-preemptive values. And to me, it just sort of seems like the only way to be successful once you've started to take those things away is to buy everybody and become this, you know, and you know, to me, it's not about, you know, singling out Clear Channel. They are, you know, when you own 10 times the stations of your next biggest, you know, competitor, you know, I mean, they draw a lot of attention. It's like, you know, Ma Bell or Big Steel, you know, or whatever. It just is what it is. But not only is it, you know, not necessarily good for communities, I just, you know, as a former professional broadcaster, just doesn't really strike me as, you know, a particularly good way to win.
Now, the AFL has done a study, and they used it, Clear Channel as the example. I mean, talking about everything they own, how they treat the communities, how they treat the employees who are basically are people from the communities. And it's really interesting. It's posted, I believe it's on AFTRA's website, and I think it's also on
It's also at reclaimthemedia.org, yeah. I think getting back to ways in which the structure of the industry has changed. I think with the rapid rise in size of these corporations and becoming publicly traded companies, programming decisions are getting made by people who acknowledge and sort of just say frankly that their main business is not making radio programming decisions, but selling audiences to advertisers. And with that in mind, I mean that servicing these traditional values of radio becomes a secondary or an external priority. The traditional categories of values by which the FCC is intended to regulate radio is to support localism, competition, and diversity. Localism meaning local accountability. And in a broader sense, to serve the public interest. And the public interest standard has never been nailed down as to exactly what that means. Nobody ever really felt like they had to nail it down very specifically because there was a general agreement about what that meant. With the coming to power, the chairmanship of the FCC of Michael Powell, very soon after coming to the chairmanship, went on a public relations attack on the very concept of public interests, saying that it was an empty regulatory standard and being really kind of mocking in a way that he doesn't anymore because the public has sort of made him out to be quite a villain because of statements like this. But I think that part of the public debate that we need to have is to identify what those values really are and to look at what types of radio or radio substitutes like XM and web radio for sure. Where are the chinks in the armor that people are going to? People are leaving commercial radio for web radio. Also, the rise of low-power FM, or interest in low-power FM, is an example of, you know, where the FCC has even acknowledged there's a problem here, and we need to create a new kind of a a venue for people to hear these kinds of locally accountable messages.
But one of the things that's happened in the last kind of wave of deregulation is that a lot of kind of set-aside frequencies that were set aside in really good kind of, you know, heartfelt, for, you know, good purposes, have been flipped in the last wave of, you know, of deregulation. And you know, so there also kind of has to be a plan if, you know, low-power FM is the answer to, you know, to make sure that moving forward, you know, in a less kind of, you know, philosophical time, Clear Channel isn't going to be able to then, you know, buy up all of these new, you know, private low-powered stations as well. Because it's, I mean, this kind of thing has been done before. I think that, you know, another thing that's changed is, you know, little things that deregulation has, you know, has kind of done. I used to need to get a FCC license to do, you know, an air shift. I used to have to do transmitter meter readings and actually go out and look at the red lights on the towers. I mean, a lot, and it just kind of, to me, this is, you know, to give you an indication of how it can have an effect. You know, when you go to get a license to drive a car, it makes you feel like you're responsible to, you know, to other people, you know, who are on the road. If you have a pilot's license, it kind of carries with it the feeling that, you know, you're responsible for, you know, for the safety of other people. Little things like having to get a broadcast license, you know, that's got a stamp on it from the government. Things like kind of, you know, being responsible. I mean, in the advertising world, these radio companies have come under fire for not being as accountable as TV companies for when their spots run and how their spots run and that type of thing. It's just, you know, the deregulation has created this, you know, it's not a lawlessness necessarily, but a kind of, you know, inability to let the curtain, you know, or an unwillingness to let the curtain down and be, you know, scrutinized by anyone.
Well, what's one thing that's really important about that is there used to be all kinds of strict requirements, EEO requirements, figuring, you know, if you hire different kinds of people from different backgrounds, you will present more of a diversity in viewpoints. Those have all been basically scrapped. And that's why, you know, although one of the three prongs that radio is supposed to serve is diversity of viewpoints, they don't. I mean, what was really amazing about the June 2nd coalition of groups opposing further deregulation was the breadth of the groups.
Exactly.
From the most conservative to the most liberal groups all together saying radio is, and, you know, deregulation is wrong. It doesn't serve diversity of viewpoints. And that, you know, with deregulation and along with that, just slashing, they used to have to show that they, you know, reached out in interviewing and there were guidelines. All gone.
The public file that anybody could come in and inspect. Like, you know, I mean, it seems like little things, but the overall sense is that no one's paying attention. No one, you know, kind of is minding the store. No one cares. And it really kind of makes, you know, it easy for the operators to feel like, you know, nobody's going to kind of, you know, come in and check up on them.
A lot of the conservative groups, culturally conservative groups that have come on, piled onto this thing, are coming from a place of, well, the liberal media is terrible. It's something that we probably wouldn't agree with. But a lot of it is this local community folks. A radio executive from my hometown in Durham, North Carolina, spoke at the FCC hearing at Duke University last spring, saying, look, I own radio stations and a television station. I don't want to subject my audience. I'll get hell from my audiences if I decide, if CBS forces me to play So You Want to Be a Millionaire or whatever it is. You know, that is different from the values that I want to. That's part of my local authority of making these kinds of decisions. And when those decisions are concentrated so much, it's a scary thing. And one thing that's happened in the past week is we see that when these big broadcasters like Clear Channel and Infinity get a slight slap on the wrist for the indecency stuff with the firing of the Love Sponge and these things, we see Clear Channel immediately, you know, eating crow before the Congress. But instead of saying, yes, these are our values, maybe we need to look at changing them, they pass the buck to the broadcasters and saying, you know, we were shocked to hear that our DJs were saying these things.
Yeah, they threw Bubba under the bus. Yeah, right, exactly.
Right.
And it's, you know, I mean, the Howard Stern, you know, is really kind of easy to shine a spotlight on, you know, or when you need a lightning rod. But to me, you know, the it's sort of insulting that, you know, that companies feel like their whole the localism discussion is about local values or local, you know, decency or whatever. To me, I mean, and to Ann's point, one of the first people to rush to, you know, Howard Stern's defense was Rush Limbaugh, which should set off some red flags, you know, right there when you see those two guys on the same page on just about anything. But they really did throw their air personalities under the bus. They also said that air personalities are going to be, you know, responsible for paying fines, not Clear Channel or, you know, or whatever, whoever the ownership group was. And yeah, there's this hypocrisy that, you know, everybody kind of knows, you know, quote unquote, everybody knows what gets ratings. You know, the Super Bowl discussion was kind of, you know, had a lot of the same themes, the Super Bowl halftime show. Everybody knows what to do to get, you know, to get ratings. But then when someone kind of crosses, as Jonathan would say, this invisible line, you know, in the pursuit of ratings so that the companies can, you know, push advertising rates and make more money, then the air personality gets thrown under the bus, is responsible for, you know, for everything, as if they never had some kind of mandate to go out there and get ratings at all costs.
Right.
And the Super Bowl, incident was easily foreseeable. It's a result of deregulation. I mean, and cops have said, you know, if Viacom didn't own both CBS that was broadcasting the football game and MTV, who would have thought to put, you know, an MTV-like halftime show at a football game? It's owned by the same people, and they want to, you know, use it all.
Yeah, and Janet Jackson was the one, I'm sorry, who kind of, you know, got thrown under the bus there. You know, it's the talent that's kind of taken the, you know, the wrath. And as someone pointed out, you know, it was MTV doing the halftime show. What did they think they were going to get, a church social? It's, you know, MTV pushes it and pushes it and pushes it, and then when someone crosses the line, it's a shock.
Okay, we only have a couple minutes left. I think we've clearly defined what the problem is. 2 minutes to define the solution.
Well, that's what we're going to do this afternoon. And I urge people to come down. We're going to have a fairly open discussion with panelists having these kind of interactions on stage and also taking questions from the audience. Mike is one of the moderators. Ross Reynolds from KUOW is the other one. We want to brainstorm and get everyone's best ideas about not what the problems are, per se, although we'll talk about that too, but what some of the solutions are. You know, we need to address the concern of pay for play, that where the money changing hands is what defines to a large extent what gets aired on music stations. We should talk about inducements to improve the amount of local ownership and minority ownership. We can talk about freeing or deregulating low power FM if you want. Other ideas?
Well, I think that, yeah, it's moving on to, you know, kind of things like, you know, is it worth legislating, you know, voice tracking, for example? Is the savings to the companies worth the loss in, you know, local economies? But basically just kind of, you know, everybody there is, you know, trying to do their job the best that they can. And I think, and is willing to be on the hook for kind of making the you know, kind of process a little more transparent. So it's a good opportunity for people to, you know, see that the broadcasters in town aren't, you know, bad people, you know, making bad decisions for bad reasons, and open to kind of, you know, seeing us move the ball down the field on, you know, issues that affect Seattle.
Yeah, and I think that's what we're going to do this afternoon. And I do think we have an opportunity and an obligation to it. I mean, these are our airwaves. The public owns the airwaves. And we're giving a license to a company. And as I believe it was somebody from Clear Channel said to Congress about Pale, well, I have a fiduciary duty to, you know, my
shareholders.
To my shareholders to accept this money. Well, then they're, with what's happened in ownership development, their fiduciary duty to their shareholders may conflict with their duty as a licensee, what they've given a license to provide. So I think we have an opportunity now to lay out some groundwork, you know, things like no pay for play, things like, you know, maybe not forbidding voice tracking, but forbidding voice tracking unless it's announced so that their local community is not deceived into thinking that the person is local. You know, programming decisions being made in the local community with some maybe perhaps local artists, you know, either an a requirement to play local artists, or certainly the requirement that the local programmer not be fed what he has to play so that local artists have a chance.
We're going to have a great conversation, and we won't be talking just to ourselves. We've timed this thing while the FCC is going around the country holding localism hearings. we're going to try to enter our discussion into the FCC record. We've also gotten commitments from several federal legislators who are excited about what we're doing. Maria Cantwell will have a representative there and have committed to being briefed by us afterwards. So we're hoping to actually create some ideas for legislation.
All right. And that's from 3 o'clock to 7 o'clock today at EMP in the JBL Theater. That is free to the public, which I guess would be free to everyone, just like our airwaves. All right. I want to thank all three of you for coming in this morning.
Thanks, Mike.
We have just been talking with Jonathan Lawson, who is the director of Reclaim the Media, Mike Tierney, who is with Blue Team Management, and Ann Chadovitz, who is the national director of sound recordings of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.